The 2012 Entrepreneur of the Year is John Alexander, class of 74 and 76, founder of the Seaboard Group Incorporated and Cornell University trustee. John's stewardship of Cornell University has spanned the last 30-plus years. Watch this heartfelt presentation by John Alexander as he talks about his entrepreneurial journey and Cornell University.
Thanks, everybody, for being here. What a fabulous turnout for a fabulous and very deserving awardee. Each year, the Entrepreneurship at Cornell celebration, we take the time to honor a Cornell graduate as the Cornell Entrepreneur of the Year. The standards for this award are high and define entrepreneurship in more than monetary terms. The Entrepreneur of the Year must have started and successfully managed a business, contributed substantially to the turnaround or growth of a business, or managed a larger business with notable entrepreneurial achievements, contributed to the private enterprise system in ways that are an inspiration to others, used his or her business skills and creativity to enrich humanity, and conducted all business and personal relationships with the highest integrity. It is this combination of entrepreneurial achievement, community service, and high ethical standards that we have celebrated each year at Cornell since 1984. And I'm delighted today to welcome back several previous winners of the Entrepreneur of the Year Award to the celebration. I believe you're all here, and if you are, as I name you, please stand and be recognized. Bob Felton, class of 61 of Indus International. Bob. Harvey Kinzelberg, class of 67 of the Meridian Group. Harvey, how are you? Kevin McGovern, class of 70 of McGovern Capital. And Jeff Parker, he's got a lot of degrees, so hold on. It's 65, an MEng in 66, and an MBA in 70 of Corporate Communication Broadcast Networks. Jeff. But now it's my honor to introduce to you the 2012 Cornell Entrepreneur of the Year, a phenomenon in the world of business who launched an extraordinary success story while he was still a student at Cornell. John Alexander was a physics major, graduating in 1974, and went on to earn his MBA at the Johnson School 2 years later. As a student, he worked for Cornell Dining, and that experience contributed to his ideas for a new business. He founded Seaboard with two partners, at first operating out of his New York City apartment while working for Bankers Trust, now Deutsche Bank, where he was a vice president. He also formed Timar Management Services, a provider of euro currency arbitrage and euro dollar CD trading software, which provided him with the capital to advance Seaboard. By 1979, he was able to devote himself to Seaboard full time. He moved the company from New York City to Ithaca, where it continued developing software for food and nutritional services. That small start would grow into a highly successful group of enterprises providing not only food service software, but cashless campus card systems, integrated security solutions, and software for such student-related needs as housing. Seaboard broke new ground with what we now take for granted as a card swiping system, which is so familiar to us today but was very new at the time. By 2004, when John Alexander sold the majority of his shares, the company had more than 240 employees and over 4,000 clients around the world. John remained as chair till 2008, when Seaboard was sold to a public company. Many Ithacans, by the way, have fond memories of a much smaller business operated by John Alexander. He and his partners created a Mexican restaurant, Coyote Loco, a popular East Hill destination from 91 to 2003. John and his wife, Elaine Alexander, class of 77, who I want to take a moment to recognize. Are terrific members of this community, generous philanthropists who have served numerous good causes in the greater Ithaca area. They have raised funds for the Hangar Theater, enabling the theater to make major renovations. And John has served on the board of United Way of Tompkins County and headed the capital campaign of the Food Bank of the Southern Tier. The Alexanders are dedicated Cornellians as well. John has served two terms on the Board of Trustees and is now a Cornell Presidential Counselor. He also currently serves on the board of the Cornell Center for Technology, Enterprise, and Commercialization, and on the Advisory Board for Entrepreneurship at Cornell. He helped to support the building of Cornell's first student-designed and built solar house, which earned high marks in the solar decathlon competition that I'm sure many of you followed. He later purchased the house, and it now serves as a guest house at the Alexander's home near Kugel Lake. I'm also pleased to note that among the Alexander's four children are one Cornell alum and two current students. John Alexander truly embodies the entrepreneurial spirit and combines it, as many of you know, with a naturally gracious humility. I had the pleasure of being the first to tell him that he had been chosen for this award, and he was absolutely taken by surprise, which is a sign of the man. Among the many qualities that so many of us admire in John, he is an open and exacting learner of new things. He likes to see things start and grow and succeed. He believes in people. He invests in them and their ideas wisely, and he is generous beyond description with his time, resources, and indeed with himself. Please join me in welcoming our 2012 Entrepreneur of the Year, John Alexander.
Excuse me, I just have to do a little email. That's a timer. David, thank you. That was a generous introduction. Actually, that was a pretty good complete presentation. Any questions? It's an honor. It's a terrific honor to be here today with my family, with a lot of my friends from Seaboard, from Coyote Loco, and a lot of the people I've worked with in the community over the years. The fact that you would take time out of your schedules this afternoon to come sit and listen to this puts a little bit of performance anxiety into my presentation, so if I look just a little nervous, it's partly because of that and partly because the president told me that we needed to actually end on time. So we're going to see how that goes. I was thinking about the question of how I actually ended up with this incredible honor, and as David said, I was really surprised when he told me that I was the guy. In the past, I've had things in my life that I worked towards. I was an Eagle Scout, and that meant a lot. I was actually a Boy Scout until the age 23. So it kind of took me a while to get there. For those of you who are Boy Scouts, I was Vigil Honor in the Order of the Arrow, so that was a big, big, big deal for me. Graduated from Cornell twice, which was exciting. And I even became a Cornell Alumni Elected Trustee, although that's not actually a job you can work for. It's sort of, you work at Cornell, but then that happens to you, unbeknownst to you in my case. When I was nominated for that position, the then chair of the board, Harold Tanner, called me and told me that I had been nominated and he wanted me to run. And I kind of shared with him that, confidentially, I'm not used to running for things that I don't know I'm going to win in advance. And he told me, "Don't worry," he said, there is a loser's club. You know, every year we have four nominees and we have two people who win, and there's a loser's club. And actually, Sandy Weil is the president of the loser's club. For those who don't know Sandy Weil, he's the man who led Citigroup, Citibank. It's had a lot of names, stocks going up and down, but it's a big organization, a couple big towers in New York City, and a hell of an organization. He was the president of the loser's club. He did, however, go on to be asked to join our board and has done the most unbelievable things for Cornell University and for our medical college. So I figured if the president of the Losers Club can become, and by the way, did I forget to say, he was the first Entrepreneur of the Year. So he was the first in this line. And if he could go on to do it, that gives me hope. You know, when I look back, people say, well, how does one do this? How does one go about doing it? And unfortunately, I did keep notes. I had a diary. It was electronic. It was kept in a variety of different handheld devices, all of whose hard disks crashed. I've lost all the notes. The only one who remembers the really good stories are my partners and my wife. And I'm hoping they'll be discreet today as I go through this. But as I think back, people say, what was the real secret? What was the secret of getting there? I mean, I have to say, in the end, it was hard work. We did a lot of things right and more things wrong, and we just kept plugging at it and plugging at it. On a day like today, I came with a speech, and then I got talking to a bunch of young entrepreneurs through the course of the day. We had a panel discussion this morning, and they told me how they did what they did. And many of them did much more than I did, but in like 4 years. Those people could finish this presentation on time. In my case, I started the work in 1972. We incorporated the company in 75, and I sold my part of my interest in it in 2004 and the rest in 2008. So 29 years, just kind of a slow learner. So for anybody who's a slow learner, this may give you hope. You'll not only have an entrepreneurial opportunity, but you can have lifetime employment. And I've got 36 minutes to go. So what is an entrepreneur? First, I thought it would be useful to define terms. What is an entrepreneur? And George W. Bush once famously said, when he was discussing the decline of the French economy with Tony Blair, he said, you know, the problem with the French is they don't have a word for entrepreneur. So I'm just reminded that some people may be confused about what entrepreneurism is or what some of the root words are that we might be discussing. So I thought I'd start with that. But I have a definition. I have a definition, and I'm going to share it with you and talk about it a little bit. The best definition I've seen was actually conceived 37 years ago by a Harvard Business School professor, a guy named Howard Stevenson. And I found it in a book called Breakthrough Entrepreneurship. One of the writers of the book, a guy named Bill Bergstone, I have to read these parts because I don't know these guys personally, but I know the book. Bergstone said, people often have to say this definition out loud like 50 times before they actually get it. But once they get it, they get it. And so his definition was this. Entrepreneurship is the pursuit of opportunity without regard to the resources currently controlled. Okay? The pursuit of opportunity without regard to the resources currently controlled. Every time you want to make an important decision, you've got a couple of choices. You could look at the array of choices that are out there and pick the best available option, try and make it fit. Or you can do what an entrepreneur does, or at least what his definition is, which is that you would figure out the best conceivable option and then go make it available. And that's kind of the blatant disregard for reality, the ability to bend reality to your needs and wants. That's kind of what makes the difference between a person who has that spirit and one who doesn't. And I don't know how long I was running our company before I actually ever heard the word entrepreneur. I feel like now it is a buzzword for sure, but I thought it might be useful at least to share that one thought, the pursuit of opportunity without regard to resources currently employed. That sort of implies not taking no for an answer, too, and being maybe just a little bullheaded when you're pretty sure you're right. And that will happen if you're a good entrepreneur and you've surrounded yourself with the right people. You know, preparing for a presentation like this is a challenge because in some respects, I'm preaching to the choir. Some of you out there have got, very few have longer, but some have much more distinguished entrepreneurial careers. And a few of you actually have longer careers as well. So I think when people say, what will be the takeaway from this? It is that the possibility exists for almost anyone to pursue an entrepreneurial career if you wish. And whether that's your full-time job, whether that's your nights and weekend job, it doesn't matter. The opportunity is there if you make the choice. Winston Churchill said, a pessimist sees the difficulty in every opportunity, and an optimist, or in my case, an entrepreneur, sees the opportunity in every difficulty. Kind of just a glass half full, glass half empty sort of thing. I've only spent a day with a group of you, and I have to say I was confused about exactly what to talk about after listening to you for a day because there were so many different variations and ideas on the best way to do things. But the successful entrepreneurs seem to be convinced that they're on the right path, and they do it with determination. And sometimes, and I'm just going to say this now because if it sounds by the end of this like I'm a little full of myself, it's because it's what we do. Pablo Picasso once said, give me a museum and I'll fill it. And it's kind of the way we think about opportunities. We can do something, no matter what the odds, we'll figure a way. My story as we go forward is going to be figuring that way. Figuring that way and doing it through a team that you put together. I came to Cornell to study math and physics, and I had a great undergraduate career here in the early 70s. I came to study cosmic gamma ray physics. I worked for 3 years. It's hard to say this in front of faculty, because when I say I had a research assistantship and I was an experimentalist, that really sounds very full of oneself for an undergraduate. But I actually had 3 years of working 25 hours a week during the school year, 40 hours to 50 hours during the summer, building a cosmic gamma ray telescope that we flew every summer in Texas. And I was way, way deep into geekhood. We were studying what's now known to be a pulsar at the center of the Crab Nebula, a former career that gives my kids a reason to chuckle. Dad studied crabs in Texas. But I came to Cornell as an electronics geek. I was a ham radio operator. I loved building circuits and stuff like that. And I had the skill with the soldering iron that most Cornell, most admitted students didn't have. So I was employable. I had a job, a part-time job doing that. And then I didn't really have enough money to quite get through my whole freshman year. And so I began looking around for another job. I got talking to the director of dining services about the fact that Cornell, now I'm from New Jersey. So I said, Cornell does not have a Wawa. We need to have a Wawa, which is a convenience store, like a 7-Eleven. And he said, well, what would it take to create a Wawa? Well, now, I don't know exactly if he knew any at all where I was going with this. But I said, well, you know, you got to get refrigeration, and you got to get signage. You need space. He says, we have space. That's not a problem. So I went through the list, and he said, well, what would it cost to open a Wawa here on Cornell campus? And I was kind of doing the mental math, but I mean, I had not studied this. I had worked as a clerk in a ShopRite in New Jersey as a kid. And I'm thinking, all right, well, I'm thinking 50, 100 grand. That was a little bit light, it turns out. But what we ended up doing, we actually went out. I got a friend of mine who I used to work night crew with at ShopRite. We went and rented a tractor trailer, went down to New Jersey and found a ShopRite that was being gutted for a renovation. They were willing to donate anything we could pick up and put on the truck and take to Cornell. So we filled the truck with refrigerators, shelves, cash register stands, the works, brought it all up here. We then laid it all out in the parking lot, the circle in front of Clara Dixon Hall, and spray painted it with little sprayers, you know? Spray painted it, moved it into Clara Dixon Hall, and opened the first pickup store. 3 months later, it was doing pretty well, and we opened another one on West Campus. So that was sort of my second job, and kind of where I got the idea that maybe I was doing the right thing in high school. I could get a job working for a grocery store, and I should just maybe stick to this. Forget the physics. Well, I opened the two stores. I then hired assistant managers in each one, created a position for myself as the coordinator of these two, thinking the next year that would be even greater. I would have risen to a much higher level. Only to come back in September to be told by the professional full-time manager that they really didn't need that coordinator. I was fired. So I then went to the Cornell Daily Sun looking for jobs. And the highest paying advertised position was that as a systems analyst working for the Department of Dining. Well, I thought, this is great, because I've already worked for dining. I've opened two grocery stores. I'm storied. I'm a success. So I went into the office of Jim Collins, who's sitting right over there. Then the business manager, and said, well, fortunately you came after the grocery stores, so you don't know why I was fired, but I know you're looking for a systems analyst, and I'd like that job. And we had a great conversation, and I think at some point he or somebody asked, well, what languages do you program in? It's like, well, I don't actually program, but I'd really like that job. I'm enthusiastic about that job. And I worked out well last year in the grocery store. Maybe it'll work out. So they gave me a break, and I got the job. And it took a few weeks to learn to program, but long story short, I worked for Cornell Dining for several years and developed a computer system that helps them to manage their purchasing and receiving and inventory and all the way up through nutritional analysis of recipes and that sort of thing. So I got to the end of my junior year with just about enough credits to graduate, just a little short of that. And at that time, Cornell was giving me, I think, $1,500 a year. So I maybe could have worked hard and graduated early, but that would have meant giving back $1,500. I would never do that. So I had to figure out what to do with that last year. And I went to Fred Kahn, who was then the dean of the Arts College, and I asked him if I could possibly double register in the business school. And that hadn't been done before but from the Arts College. It had been done by lots of engineers. But I think he must have gotten a look at my transcript, and he knew that I needed a second chance. So he allowed me to do that, and I entered the Johnson, what's now the Johnson School. Cornell really gave me a great push to start my company in the form of a form letter that I received that said, we were serious about the bursar bill we sent you. It needed to have been paid by whatever that date was, and if you don't do that really soon, you need to withdraw. And so I said, well, there's no way. I had no money anywhere, and my parents had none, so I withdrew. And I then got a 3x5 card, which has enough lines to put down all the number of jobs I could possibly find. And I figured out the hours times the rate. And back then, people were getting paid $4 an hour, $3.50, $5 was what I was being paid, I think, which was pretty good. There weren't enough hours. There was not enough hours in the day to actually come up with the money that I owed Cornell and to be able to live. And that was when a light bulb went off. I had 1 year of an MBA behind me, so I had some business skills. And the light bulb said, you need to have a product. You don't need to be a service anymore. You got to become a product guy, something you can sell for a lot of money. So I went back to Cornell and to my boss, who was Jim, and then to his boss, who was a guy named Art Jaeger, and then finally to his boss, who was Bill Gurwitz, the vice president for Campus Life. And I said, how's about you license me all the stuff that you paid me to develop over the last few years, and then what I'll do is I'll go sell it to other universities. That way I can come back to Cornell. I don't know if that was enough of an incentive to make them do it, but they did it. They did it. And I look at that and say that was an act of faith for sure. I thank them obsessively and continuously for it because it all worked out really well. So in 1975, we licensed what I now know is called intellectual property, the IP, from Cornell, and we started Seaboard, started the company. And I guess that was the day when I became what I now believe an accidental entrepreneur. I really had not intended to do this. I really just wanted to pay off that bill, but there was sort of no other way. Interestingly, several years later, Cornell had also developed a card access system, which you're all familiar with, which you use all throughout campus. And again, at their expense, but I went back to Cornell Dining and said, well, how would you feel about licensing that through Seaboard to other universities? Now, I haven't told you what the quid pro quo is. I know Alan Powell is wondering, I haven't seen that contract. I haven't seen that royalty stream. I don't know about those royalties. Where are they? The deal was that they would allow me to use the intellectual property as a basis for this, and that I would then give them everything I ever developed for the rest of time for free. That was the deal that they asked for. And to me, it seemed like a pretty good idea because it got me to the point where I could pay that bill. So we started, and there were three of us in this partnership, in this company. And it was myself, Jim Collins, who's here, who I haven't seen in quite some time, 30-some years, and a guy named Art Jaeger, who was then the director of dining. Jim decided to go on and have a career. He had finished an MBA here, and he decided to have a career in higher education. And so he dropped out, and that left us with a 50-50 partnership. I worked then for several years with Art Jaeger, who was the director of dining, and the man single-handedly responsible for helping with his team, including Maureen Updike and a few others, for making Cornell the number one dining services in the country. Cornell has a food service that just is far and away one of the finest and probably the finest. He taught me a lot, and when we started the business, I thought I was poor. They were adults. They were poor, too. We each put in $1,000. So there was $3,000 of initial capital. We allocated $750 for legal fees, $1,700 for travel, and $500 for marketing. We went to an ad agency here in town called The Hour Agency, owned by a guy named J.B. Graves, and we told J.B., here's what we need. First, we need a name for the company. We need a name for our product. We need a brochure. We need stationery, envelopes, business cards, and we need a 10-foot trade show booth to take to Detroit to the NACUFS convention in 2 weeks. And he said, and what was your budget again? $500. He did it all. He did it. Because he saw he caught the vision. He saw the virtue of what we were doing, and he saw a promise in it. And we became a good customer of his and went on to continue to do that. We actually moved our company when we got bigger. We had 6 people. We moved into the kitchen of the house, which was his office downtown on State Street. Lived there for many years. And lesson learned, don't be afraid to ask for what you need. If you ask sincerely and if there looks to be promise to your idea, you might get lucky. And we really did in that case. Some people at this point say, by the way, Seaboard, they give you the name of the company, Seaboard, C-B-O-R-D. What does that mean? Well, my first answer is always, what does that stand for? Well, we stand for truth, justice, and the American way. That'd be first. That gets a little laugh. We went to our customers a few years ago and asked them to have a kind of a contest to think about what does Seaboard stand for. And there are a few who had some delinquent accounts, and I won't tell you all the different options we got, but the best one that actually matches up with the letters was collect balances on receivables or die. which gives you an idea of the sort of sense of the sixth sense of humor that our clients have. So we now have a company, we've got marketing literature and stuff, we've got a product now. What are we missing? What do you think?
Customers,
right. We didn't have any customers. So we did a strategic analysis of the national and international market for college and university food services, including all sizes, community colleges, everything else. And then we said, let's go try and sell it to Syracuse because we can drive there. Wanted to go the closest place we could, went up there and told them that Cornell is really smart, our food service is making money and you're not, and the reason is this computer system, and so you should buy it. And we'd made 2 presentations, there was no PowerPoint. And by the way, the computer systems were on punch cards. So it wasn't a great demo. You know, if you were from Las Vegas, you could fan them out. But it wasn't a great demo. But they saw the benefits. They saw the results. And finally, they said, well, what did that cost? And Art and I, the 2 of us, were sitting there. We hadn't actually thought about that part yet. We were so excited just to get in the door, that we looked at each other, and there was a really, really uncomfortable silence for a moment or two, stroking our chins, respectively. And then I reasoned it out. And I actually have a presentation that I've given to some of the business school students on strategic pricing models. And the strategic pricing model was this. I needed $10,000 to pay my bill. I had a 50-50 partnership, and I said, $20,000. There were no competitors in the market. He bought it. It was great. And the best thing happened in the weeks that followed. A guy named Don Jacobs, who is a legendary food service director from the University of Pennsylvania, went out and told all the other Ivy League directors at one of their annual meetings. He said, you guys should go out and buy this thing now before they figure out what they've got. So that, I mean, I look at business and say, some of it's skill, some of it's luck. And he was right, but it was lucky he said it when he did, because that led to the initial sales, really, that helped to build the company. So we continued and ran the business for a while on a kind of a part-time basis. I realized by this point that to run a business like this, you need to have money, and I had none. So I finished my second year at the Johnson School, paid the bill, finished the second year at the school, interviewed, and eventually ended up going out and getting a job with Bankers Trust, which is now Deutsche Bank. And that was on the advice of my business school advisor, Dave Ollers, who may be here. Dave? Back, yeah. So Dave, I was talking to IBM and Raytheon and all kinds of things, and he said, no, you should think about banking. I was like, banking? You crazy? He said, no, not that kind of banker. Trading. Get into trading. Go down to the money market and see about that. And it turned out it was one of the best paying jobs, and so I did it. I moved down there and took the job, and was able to salt away some money for a few years. And while I was there, I went to my boss, and I was planning to eventually go back to Ithaca and pursue this business full time, but I needed a slug of cash. I needed not just a little, I needed a down payment, because I wanted to have a house that was no more than 2 houses away from Dolores and Craig Adler, who are right here. I wanted to live out in Ellis Hollow. I knew how I wanted to live, I just didn't know how to do it. And so I'd been fooling around with a calculator. Texas Instruments 59. Does anyone remember it? Programmable with a mag strip. Pretty revolutionary at the time, and still kind of capable, actually. It's helped Dave Ollers win a hell of a lot of sailing races. I know that. It optimizes his course and sail setting. He had taught me how to program this thing, and I went down there and wrote a couple of programs for euro currency arbitrage and a couple of other calculations that were tedious and impossible to do manually. And my boss actually said, it's okay, don't sell them to our competitors, but you can sell them to the brokers. That way they can bring us deals faster. It'll make them more efficient. It's fascinating, the fact that he did. I look back now on what his responsibilities were and say, he did that. I mean, that was a gift from God. So I went out and, you know, since $20,000 worked for the first sale, I thought, $20,000, that's a good price for this. So this little stick of gum that had 800 program steps on it, I sold it for $20,000, and I sold two of them. And then I had, at that point, enough money for a down payment on my house. And so about 2 weeks after I got promoted to vice president at the bank, and they gave me my 6 weeks vacation and everything else, I stepped down from my position, and my wife, Elaine, and I, and my oldest daughter, who's here, who was just about a month old then, moved back to Ithaca to pursue this entrepreneurial dream on a full-time basis. And we pursued and pursued and pursued and pursued. We weren't really making money. We were making some progress, I think, but we were a little bit more like a mouse on a, you know, on a, those little treadmill things. So I got to a point where I felt I needed some good advice and counsel, and so I thought, I'm going to organize a board just like real companies. And so I thought, where could I go to get this board? I'm just back here in Ithaca. I don't have a big network, but I do have the Cornell Business School. And so I went back to the business school, and I went to talk to a couple of people that I knew. And one was George Goetz, who was the first Barron's Professor of Entrepreneurship, and a guy who became a dear friend. The second was my B-School advisor, Dave Ollers. And they, in turn, led me to a guy named Dave Yater, who is a PhD from the Johnson School and is a telecom guy here in town. He owns All Mode Communications. These three guys came on, listened patiently, patiently. I didn't have a timer then. My speeches went on interminably. And I didn't really know much about what I was talking about either, but they were respectful and guiding. And they nudged me in the right direction and got me to the point where the company had a business plan that was well enough thought out that we actually began to stick to it year in and year out. We did pretty good at staying with it. And these guys stayed with me for several years. We had, like all small businesses, entrepreneurships, we had planned for the IPO. I mean, you normally make that plan on the second or third board meeting. And we were doing about $700,000 a year in sales, give or take a bit. And the cool thing was we were growing like gangbusters. We were growing at 20% a year. 700,000, 840, 980. You can do the math, all right? It only gets exciting in 29 years. It takes a long, long time for that to turn into something worthwhile. But my board had come on, and we were really hoping to IPO, and what became painfully apparent maybe 3 years into that was that this thing's going to grow 20% until the end of time. There's nothing he can do. We said that would be great, and it is great, but we just didn't do the math beforehand to figure out that it doesn't get us to anywhere near an IPO. So my board stayed with me, but while they were with me, they helped me to do a couple of really important things, and their names are Bruce and Tim, Bruce Lane and Tim Tai, who are both here. They helped me to think about bringing on management talent to help do the things that I wasn't really good at, and to divide some of the responsibility. So Tim and Bruce came and joined me, and we actually stepped up the pace of growth somewhat, and we became profitable. It was not just sales. When I talk about 20% growth, there were different things on the balance sheet and income statement that were growing at 20% at various times. Sometimes they were expenses, sometimes they were revenue. Once Tim and Bruce came on, they were actually profits, and that was a really rewarding and kind of a new thing for me, so it's pretty exciting. So then what happened after that? I took on a kind of a different role because I was kind of I started as a programmer. I left out the part where I went through the corporate divorce with my first partner, but when we did go through that divorce, which lasted a year and a half and entailed no salary and a really ugly kind of situation, everything that a normal divorce has, but without salary on either side, when we finally got through all that, I remember breathing a sigh of relief when I came home and told Elaine, you know, we finally settled this thing out. And I can remember waking up the next morning and saying, oh my God, who's going to sell? Who's going to sell this stuff for us? And on that day, I kind of flip-flopped over from being a programmer, which it turns out, in retrospect, I wasn't great at, to being, I was self-taught, but to being a salesman, which I also wasn't great at the beginning, but I was a true believer in the product, and I think that's the first thing you need to have to be a great salesman and a spokesperson for your company. So I went out, and you know, by hook or by crook, and through a lot of mistakes and embarrassment, I learned to sell. And for the rest of my career, until I sold the company and stepped down as CEO in 2004, I sold, and really, really enjoyed it. We had some things that worked in our favor that were in terms of our successes, you know. And one was being first to market with a product, and you hear a lot about that. It's somewhat overrated today. I think people sometimes say, if you're first to market, you're going to be the big winner, and people go out of their way to try and create some complicated definition of what it is they do so that nobody else ever did that before, so they are first to market. It needs to be first to market with something useful that everybody gets and understands. But if you do that, you know, being first to market is newsworthy. You get free publicity in the industry because you're doing something, you're breaking new ground. We actually managed to get our story written into the Congressional Record, and I have a certificate at home from the Pope thanking me for our work for college and university food service and humanity. Thank God. Being first and doing something exciting in a town like Ithaca was a cool thing too, because it attracted great talent. It was not hard to attract the very, very best people because we were kind of out there on the cutting edge. And for a millisecond or two, there was no competition. We had a brief period of time where we enjoyed the a wide open market. That didn't last too long. We were the leaders and we educated the market. I now know, and now advise young entrepreneurs, if you can find a market that's already educated, that's better. Trying to have to tell people that they have a problem, and then for $50,000 you can fix it for them, that's a little hard, and it requires real selling skills, but we had that. Interestingly enough, in the access control system business, which I told you we brought into the fold a few years later, we were not the first. There was a company called Griffin Technologies out of Victor, New York. These guys were first in that market, and we were second. The difference is that somewhere in our business plan there was the words customer service, and they didn't have that in their plan. And that gave us such an edge. It turned out it was best to be second rather than first because there was a standard of reference, and it wasn't a high standard of reference. So we've had kind of experience in both of those. So I started as the programmer. I was always my one partner and I who divorced were co-presidents. When your business card says you're the co-president of a company, you should know that there is a problem right there. I should have anticipated that a long time ago. But I tried to move to a role of leadership rather than managing, and Tim and Bruce were way better at managing than I was. So leadership involved saying, as we expand our product lines, as we expand in different markets, you know, which one we go to next and why? And which ones won't we go to and why? And I liked that role. I really enjoyed it. And we were able to, every couple of years, we would either come up with a new product for an existing market, or we would come up with a new market to which we would sell our existing products. And that's a kind of a slow, progressive, incremental growth strategy that we talked a little bit about this morning. And it worked out really well. I didn't know much about selling, but one thing I had was confidence and belief in the product. Sometimes it was falsely placed confidence. Sometimes my belief was in things that I'd made up that weren't actually true. But I always believed. And I looked sincere, and I usually started the presentation by telling them what I knew I learned in the Boy Scouts. From the beginning, we've relied on our customers for a lot of input. The customer's not always right, but they're always the customer, and you have to keep their place in your business straight. Our customers gave us a great deal of their time and information. And we tried to always remember who brought us to the dance, which was our customers. Henry Ford once said that if we gave customers what they wanted, they would say they wanted a faster horse. And we saw that sometimes. It turned out at the big picture level, our customers didn't often come to us with really good, big, bold, new ideas for products. But at the incremental stage of improving the products and making them better and better and better, they were terrific at it. And every time we made a little change, a little tweak to something, each customer, the customer whose tweak it was, got some credit for it, and they would tell 10 more people, and so on and so forth. And that's what viral growth is about when you've got a good customer organization. I think if my partners had any time up here on the stage, which I'm probably not going to give them, they would say that he did the most that he could with his life, given his ADHD, and the fact that he was so impatient. Bill Gates, I did some research for this thing, believe it or not, and Bill Gates actually says that he thinks that patience is a real important business virtue. And that surprised me, because I read a lot by Bill Gates, and I think he actually misspoke. I think what he meant to say was persistence. Patience is kind of just sort of sitting there passively. Persistence is staying on it. And I think that that is one of the things that really makes the difference between success and failure. Our company has had many, many a January release that was released in August of the following year. But we didn't give up on getting it done. And we didn't give up on communicating with our customers and what we were trying to do. Now here at Cornell, when we talk about intellectual property and trying to build companies around technology, we often think that the first and most important thing you've got to do is patent the product, you know, get the protections in there. We never had a patent on anything in our product line for 30 years. Do we have any now? I don't know. Do we? I don't know. It's a lot of paperwork. And actually, famously, Bill Gates, again, obviously, you know, I've read one book this year. Bill Gates did say that intellectual property has the shelf life of a banana. There's ways of imitating, tweaking, and doing other things that make it less valuable. What we did is improve the product every year and have an ongoing licensing arrangement with our customers where they got every improvement we ever developed in the future at no additional charge. And that little model worked great. And they were anxious, yes, they were clamoring at the doors for all the features that they wanted, but they kept clamoring, and even when they were late, they waited. So it was a good deal. All right, I'm gonna turn to philosophy. The secret sauce of Seaboard, you know, really what made the difference. And here I'm partly quoting the gospel according to Tim Tighe, who took over as CEO after I stepped. You didn't know I was going to do this, but I thought you were actually quite eloquent in one of your emails, so I'm going to read parts of it. Because I had to do a reality check, because I know in staff meetings, if I would start doing something like this, either he or Bruce, they would stand up and either walk out or would say, wait a minute, bullshit, not true. But so this, I'm quoting you in this case. The secret sauce, the values, the ethics, and the aspects of our organization that makes it a success, I think a kind of an unspoken attribute is a corporate sense of fairness and responsibility in everything we do. Said another way, if it's only about making money for you, then you're probably not cut out to do what it takes to make a small business into a bigger one. We were and are far from perfect at Seaboard, but we never spent time crafting excuses. And this is something, this is an attribute that is pervasive down through the organization. This is not just coming from the CEO. We were figuring out how to make it right and make every client reasonably happy. We were successful because of a deep-seated need to please, and Tim calls it a genetic corporate flaw that made it hard for us to accept failure in any client account. It turns out the need to please keeps you in very close contact with your customers, especially the ones where you're screwing up. And that turns out to work really well as a basis for the companies evolving, because they would push back and those customers would help us to make a better system. And I love this little quote, Tim, so I'm just going to use it. Instead of finding your niche finds you. So you stay close to your customer and the niche finds you. I think that's kind of what happened. And we try where we can to hire people with that corporate genetic defect, that they're people pleasers and they want to take good care of their customers. We're going, in October we'll be in our 33rd annual user group conference. Unfortunately too big for the Statler now, but where's it going to be this year? Who knows? Atlanta, yes, that's it. And every year the clients elect an advisory council and they boss us around and tell us what to do and they give us long, 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 long lists. And then we come back and say, all right, now cut the list back. Just give us the important stuff. Now that we've got it all on the board, let's do the important stuff. And they collaborate with us. And that, I have to say, that has worked so well. And part of me thought, maybe that works so well because I'm so charming. But I've been gone since 2004, and it seems to be working better than ever. So I think we actually hit on a formula that works. You know, I had a great team, and my leadership was something that they sometimes worked around, worked through. But I had a great board, you know, and I had a terrific board in the beginning when I really needed a sounding board that would keep me honest and make me accountable. When it was my money in the business and I could make or lose money, I wasn't as accountable as I was when I had their investment, because I had to come back to them and show what I was doing positively every day to move the company forward. I became extremely accountable, and it became very clear to them in 3 years that at 20% growth, we're never going to IPO. So we ended up buying out our original investors for a nice return, I think. But by that time, they had helped me to recruit my two managers and a small management team that allowed the company to really continue to sail. I'm not saying that it was good to get rid of an outside board, because it was hard without them, but they realized that what we were planning on doing originally was probably not going to happen, that we were going to probably grow 20% until the end of time, and we had a corporate genetic defect, which is a risk profile, that prevented us from taking the kind of risks you need to do to grow a lot faster than that. Once we sold the company, and we had taken a little money off the table, then our risk preference went up dramatically. And we were happy to go borrow money from anyone who wanted to lend it to us. And then we'd use that money to buy other companies, and we'd clean them up and make them very successful. And you know, we were buying companies that were as big as we were, whereas previous to that, we were buying companies out of cash flow, small investments of 5, 10, 15% of our earnings. So my second board taught us to love risk, love debt, and so the company grew significantly. And they let us do things that I could never have done on my own, because I had everything. I had my whole family, literally, all of our money and all of my time in the company. So I couldn't put it at risk. We didn't always agree with our board. One time, my first board came and they said, we've been with you for like a year and a half. This C-board? What's that? Where did you come up with that? We want to change the name of this company to Alexander Associates. And my ego puffed up, and I thought, this is going to be great for about a minute. And I realized that we've been selling for about 7 years, that we had established a brand out there that certainly nobody else was using that name. It wasn't like Acme Roto-Rooter. So I had to stand up to him and say, we're not doing it. Thank you very much. I appreciate that you think I have such credibility that somebody would buy from that company, but I bet there's another Alexander Associates out there. We're sticking with C-Board, and we did. And it worked out well. So, I've talked a lot about what got us to where we were, and one of the important decisions we made early on was that we would differentiate our company based upon service. Now, duh, I think everybody says that, right? But I think that there are three basic ways that are unrelated that you can differentiate yourself. Service is one, having the best service. Technology, having the highest tech, whiz-bangiest product, that's kind of like Intel and Apple, I think. And price. Price would be Walmart, for example. And service might be Neiman Marcus or someone like that. We picked service, and I think we picked it with an understanding that we could probably not, in most cases, could not have the leading cutting-edge technology, and we would never be the cheapest product. We would be much, much more expensive than other people's products, because it was going to cost money and take people to deliver that service. So we stuck with that for a long time. And we stuck close to the customer. And that always just felt good to me, first of all. It was a warm, fuzzy feeling that we were doing that. And the customers responded appropriately to that, I think. But every so often, you're looking for some validation. So I got a call, again, from Tim the other day. And he said, well, years ago, anybody who would sit down and listen to us for 5 minutes, we would buy them a beer. We would take them out and we would, try to become their best friend. And we had someone who fit that profile, and then that person's boss made a tragic mistake and bought from our competitor. I think it was 15 years ago, more or less, 10, 15, give or take. So fast forward 15 years, and that competitor makes a strategic business decision that they're going to terminate the maintenance and service on all of their Unix-based products. So the company, dutifully, using the most current technology, lets their customers know that the millions of dollars they spend on those systems, it's now no longer supported. And they did that by sending out a text message to their customers. I love that part. We were talking this morning in the panel discussion about how our grandchildren, understand and use all this technology, and I'm just so grateful that somebody's grandchild works for that competitor, because the guy who was then our prospect 15 years ago, of course, is working hard now to roll out the red carpet to bring our people in to replace that system. And actually, the second time around when that happens, price is not so much of an object. It's a beautiful place to be. You can get a much better price if you're not, texting your customer that you're cutting them off. So there, we're getting close to where I need to slow down a little. And so I'm going to talk about the issue of payback. I've been fortunate enough to sell the company, take a little money off the table, have a little more time to myself. And now I've got the time and some resources to think about giving back. In this room, there are a lot of people who have given a great deal to Cornell over the years. But one of the things that I've become aware of, partly as a trustee here and partly from just involvement in philanthropy, is that even when you're paying full tuition for a child at a place like Cornell, you're paying like a third of the cost of educating that child. You are not, even though you may think you're paying a lot of money, you are not paying the full freight. And when we live in a town like Ithaca and build a business, and when we are able to hire people and retain, how many Seaboard employees are here with 15 years of service? We got a bunch here, right? We got a whole bunch, 20? 25, that's a bunch. We're retiring people from the company now who have more years of service than I do. A town like this makes it possible to build a company where you don't have turnover, you know, where people want to stay here. And why is that? Is that because of some wonderful thing that I did or our company did? No. There's a lot of other people who put time and energy into making this a really nice place to live and to raise a family and so forth. So my message here is that we need to give back, and we need to be aware that actually we got matching grants for most of our contributions, whether it's to your company, to society, to Cornell, that somebody else was out there long before us getting that machine started. And our opportunity now, of course, is to build on what they've done, I think. One of the things that I've learned one of the opportunities I had early on at Cornell to give back was to come in and teach classes. And I kind of enjoyed that because Cornell students are very enthusiastic. This is a combination of students and alumni, but at the end of these, there's always 10 people who come to the front of the class and want to talk. Two of them tell me about a project that they have due tomorrow that they'd like to get an hour of my time to talk about. And the rest have got business plans, and they want investments, or they want advice, or they want something. I love that part, and I love the fact that we can bring, here at Cornell, we're pretty successful in bringing together people who've been titans of billion-dollar businesses and people who have run little pickle factories, and all of them have something to share. We're in a great place here because we can get access to that, to those kinds of insights. And for me, the most important thing in walking away from Seaboard was knowing that the company's culture and knowing that its success in this town would continue. It's not something you talk to your buyer about. Are you planning on leaving town? Were you thinking about making decisions on your own after you paid me for the whole thing? But it's something I worry about every day. The kind of cool thing is that today, this company's sales are high. They're well up around $100 million, maybe a little bit over. Their earnings are more than what the sales were when I left. That's a good deal. That's not an exact number, but it tells you kind of directionally how things are going. They're doing a terrific job. And we've had some of the same people. There's been great continuity in the management team, which gives me a really good, warm feeling about what I left behind. So I attribute much of this success to Cornell. And I told our would-be buyers that when we had our roadshow. We did the standard roadshow. We had a beautiful book. We had a PowerPoint presentation. It's almost that time. PowerPoint presentation with all of our pictures of Tim and Bruce and myself. And we were talking to one of the would-be buyers, and they looked at my credentials, and it said, John Alexander, AB74. And the guy looked up, and he said, oh, what the hell does AB stand for? Well, the Arts College at Cornell grants not a BA degree, but an AB degree, and that's the Artium Baccalaureatus degree. Now, some of you have known me for a long time, so you could guess what that is. This is the award to students who follow the centuries-old tradition and include in their studies significant coursework in the classics. That was me, yeah. So I was AB74, and the guy says, what the hell does that mean? Without losing a beat, our investment banker raised his hand and he said, that stands for add back. Because you could take the net present value of everything it's going to cost you to keep this guy around for the rest of time, add it back to the current, pay him some portion of that, and he'll be gone. So I like to think that I added great value. Tim points out to me that profits are up by 4.5%, or no, 4.5 times from when I left, and 0.5 times of that is my comp, which has not been paid since 2004. So I'm grateful to continue to be a part of the solution. Anyway, I was surprised when I was told that I was going to be awarded this honor because we're in company of many of previous recipients, and the list of recipients going back to Sandy Weill is unbelievable. And the difference between them and me is, as they say in accounting, the zeros are omitted. These guys are much richer, much more successful over in a diversity of industries. And so I couldn't quite figure out what it was that got me up here. And so I began thinking about, well, maybe it's not the business. Maybe it's the other stuff. Maybe it's the Cornell involvement. Maybe it's the giving back to the community. And I think if I were to give people advice, I think I'm probably better at giving advice on that part than I am at giving advice on building a company. If you want to know about how to do that, you should talk to Tim and Bruce and our management team. Now, I've talked for 29 minutes or something, and my investment banker would say that you're way too complicated. He said the success, if you want to be successful at selling your business and moving into retirement, you just have to do two things. Marry right and pick the right banker. He said, that's not necessarily in that order. But he hit on an important point, and that's about picking partners. You know, whether it's your life partner or your business partner, you need to choose carefully because people will see you standing side by side, and that other person becomes what you stand for as well. It's a decision you've got control over, and it's a decision that will affect you all your life. And, you know, my bride of 35 years in May, who says if I say more than one paragraph about her, she'll kill me, has been there as a constant supporter, an occasional critic when asked or not, and a person who has helped to keep me on the right path. I'm going to say the very same thing that I said nothing romantic in there, right? Because I'm going to say that Tim and Bruce did the same thing too. You know, they were confidants. They were good advisors. They were kind. There was no sex. But I've had great partners through my life. When you're building a business from scratch, survival is the key word. We had many, many years where there were no paychecks, where survival was in question, whether the easiest thing to do was lay a few people off and just get on with it. And we never chose to do that. And there were times when our full concentration was literally on surviving. I wasn't thinking about heading up a United Way campaign during those years. If you start a business and you don't survive, hopefully you learn something from it. You get back up and try it again. Thomas Alva Edison once said that I have not failed, I've just found 10,000 ways that won't work. Nothing wrong with that. That's a learning experience as well. I was lucky. I got into Cornell. I got to go to Cornell. I got to finish it. I did marry right. I picked the right investment banker. And now I find myself at the point where I'm really looking for opportunities to give back. In fact, one of the things you need to do once you're finally retired is to make sure that your money doesn't run out before you do. Ideally, if you can bounce the check to the funeral parlor, you've done a perfect job of planning. I'm not planning on writing that check just yet. But a confusing moment is at the end of a day where I find that I spent the whole first part of the day maybe working with investments or companies that I'm involved in and trying to figure out how to make money. And then I have a bite to eat or something for lunch, and I spend the afternoon trying to figure out how to give it away. That is always very interesting, and some days those days can be a little bit confusing. So for those of you who are looking forward and thinking about, you know, what to do with your career, interestingly, the computer business was so new when we got in it that there was limitless opportunity, and I think there still is in the internet. I think actually computers and the issues with computers are more or less solved. You know, Gates, Jobs, and a few others actually did that. Sun Microsystems, a couple others, they've kind of figured that out. So if somebody, and a lot of students ask me, well, where do you think I should go? Where should I spend my time? And I, to me, something around the theme of oil, gas, fracking or not, energy, the ecology, reversing every aspect of global warming except what's happened to Ithaca this winter. That would be really good, because I think we do have an obligation one way or another to give back, and businesses are in a position to do it mightily. And so for those of you who have that kind of either engineering or business bent to move in that direction, I would encourage it. And finally, I'd just like to say that this is an incredible honor for me. It's humbling. It's difficult because, as I say, I have to look back on 29 years to figure out what worked and what didn't. Most people can do it in two or three. But it's been a terrific opportunity for me for self-reflection. And I'm also reminded at one point, Golda Meir, when speaking with a diplomat, looked him in the eye and said, you know, don't be so humble, you're not that great. So I'm going to try and I'm not going to be that humble. I'm just going to say that according to my clock here, I should bring up the Vince Lombardi quote, which was, we didn't lose the game, we just ran out of time. Or, in the case of my presentation to you, and thank you so much for bearing with me, I just want to remind you of the words of Pancho Villa, whose last words were, don't let it end like this. Tell him I said something. Thank you all so much for bringing me today.